All right, there we go. So they found the Higgs particle this week. Did you guys hear about this?
Yes.
This is like, for particle physicists, this is like landing on the moon. This has been this collider that they built over there in Switzerland. They found it, and they announced it on July 4th, which I thought was kind of cheap. Like, we have to wait to be really sure. We're going to wait. Okay, now we're really sure on July 4th. Okay. But it's kind of a big deal. It's fascinating, kind of the discovery of something that we know is there, right? There's kind of a picture of faith, and the message today has nothing to do with that. So we'll save that for Tuesday, because we're talking about Tuesday night is faith. So anyways, that's the teaser. So the Higgs, yeah, go read up on that. That's good stuff. Today we're going to be studying in Matthew chapter 20, and I had the opportunity to go to a pastor's conference recently, hosted by my friend Rob, and he said something at the start of the conference that I think was, to me, it's right at the heart of what I feel like God has been working on in my life. He said, "Jesus insists on your greatness." Is that an interesting statement? Jesus insists on your greatness. And I think we ask a sort of question in response to that. Well, greatness, well, what do you mean? What does greatness mean? Because so often I think greatness is something that creates almost internal conflict in my heart. When I think of greatness, I think of my ego going right along with it, wanting credit, wanting affirmation, wanting power, wanting privilege. And yet Jesus unabashedly pushes us towards glory, requires so much more. We talked about this with the rich young ruler. Jesus is saying, give up everything and come with me. And the disciples are saying, well, we have. What does that mean for us? And Jesus says, thrones. You're going to sit in a throne where you're going to be in a position of acting as judge. This is way beyond the expectation of the disciples. And this insistence that, you know what is happening now, there's a story that is going on. But it's a story that is refining your life for an assignment far bigger than you realize. And so every day becomes an opportunity to grow into this role. To live, like Paul says in Hebrews, in a manner that the world is not worthy of. It's this great calling. Kierkegaard calls these people knights of faith. And that Jesus doesn't insist on this for a select group of people. As it turns out, this is the assignment for all of us. To grow into our greatness. Thomas Merton calls this our true self, who we were made to be. So what does it mean to be great? You can actually go online and figure out your greatness. Have any of you signed on to clout.com? Clout measures your influence. And so, you know, I mean, how do you not? Now you all are going to go look it up, right? You go on, and my score was 28 out of 100. I know, but then it went up. It went up to 30, and it even said, like, well done, Jeff. 30. And then, you know, I had kind of a quiet week this last week and just went on the other day, and I'm back down to 27.6 or something like that, which is depressing. But it takes and it measures your sphere of influence. This is what clout does. And it's actually become, just for the record, a common question in an interview. What's your clout score? What's your influence? How many people are you connected to that you're influencing what they think, what they do? This is where your power is. If you guys want to, like, tweet something out during the sermon today, it will actually bump my clout score maybe back over 30. So, just saying. It triggers something in us, that question, my significance. And I think that this is kind of a universal, that that we long to live a life that has meaning, that has purpose, that has significance. But we have this nature in us that is very fearful. And I think that fear takes this, what is a healthy longing for glory, and twists it. Twists it into a need for public recognition. And we see this in our jealousy at others' successes. And if we're really, really honest, in the sick sort of thing that rises up that's takes a weird sort of pleasure in others' defeats. Walker Percy has written this great book on, basically it's a self-help book, but it's kind of a mockery of a self-help book, evaluating all these weird idiosyncrasies in the human psyche, where we get excited when there's a disaster, you know, on TV or at some sort of car chase, and you know this. But there's this thing in us that's constantly afraid that we're going to be forgotten, and so it fights for our place. And underneath it, sees it as a race, as a competition, as beating somebody next to us, and that so that we can be in that kind of top percentile category. Underneath, and I think mixed in with that fear, is also a self-worship, a dangerous self-worship. That when we find ourselves in positions of power, they become positions of privilege, opportunities to extend ourselves even further, to take advantage of that, to create a life here on earth where we become kind of the Lord of our own kingdom. I'd like to say that it was religion that fought against that force, but I think so often religion just goes right along with it, doesn't it? That it becomes a way to leverage, a way to compete, a way to get what we want. I think this is so natural to us that we don't even realize it. It's like water to a fish. That constant fear. You know, I just saw a statistic and it was saying that people, you know, with Facebook and social networking are so much more connected than they've ever been, and yet loneliness is off the charts. That we have all of this connection, and yet we find ourselves in a place where those deep wounds, those fears, the selfishness, all of that is so unmet because its appetite is insatiable. We're so affected by it. I'm reading a book, I've told you about this, I'm reading a book with my small group called God Is Not Great. My son saw this on my desk and was like, "What? Dad, what's wrong with you?" It's by Christopher Hitchens. And the subtitle is How Religion Poisons Everything. And in a section called Religion's Corrupt Beginnings, he says, "Some people may be insulted at even the suggestion of a comparison here, but are not the holy books of official monotheism absolutely dripping with material yearning and with admiring, almost mouth-watering descriptions of Solomon's wealth, thriving of flocks and herds of the faithful, rewards for a good Muslim in paradise, to say nothing of many, many lurid tales of plunder and spoils. Jesus, it is true, shows no personal interest in gain, but he does speak of treasure in heaven, and even of mansions as an inducement to follow him. Is it not further true that all religions down the ages have shown a keen interest in the amassment of material goods in the real world?" And Hitchens has got this idea that, you know, it's religion that corrupts. It's religion that makes things go bad. And you know what? You can spot this sort of pattern. You can recognize it. And you see that pattern and aha. What we find is religion is just one more thing to get what we want. And what I want to say to Hitchens is I want to say first, look, just because you've spotted this sort of pattern there doesn't mean you write the entire thing off. There can be such a thing as good religion and bad religion, can't there? But what are the examples then of good religion? How do we avoid doing this very thing? And in our passage today, Jesus has anticipated this question. In fact, not just anticipated the question, he's dealing with the fallout of religion that has gone wrong. And he's been confronting it in the Pharisees battling against that as they've been doing everything they can to undermine his authority. But what Jesus finds, not surprisingly, is that even within his closest followers, this longing for recognition, this longing for greatness that is equal to position and power, is right there in their midst. So if you would, we're going to pick up right where we left off here in Matthew chapter 20. And we're going to read a story. This might be a familiar one to some of you, where two of Jesus' disciples have come up with a strategy in order to earn themselves the top two spots. And they're sneaky. You know, they do it by getting their mom to go in and speak for them. And I know, it's terrible, isn't it? Hey, Mom, would you tell Jesus? Let's go ahead and read this. In fact, I'm going to back up into verse 17 of chapter 20. And Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, and he took the 12 disciples aside, and on the way he said to them, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and scribes. They will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified, and he will be raised on the third day." I got to just stop and say, isn't it funny that they're so surprised after the fact of what took place? Jesus is basically laying out the timeline. Look, you guys, take this down. I think it's revealing. I think it shows how some information, when it's just that far off our radar, just falls on deaf ears. In verse 20, then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons, and kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left, in your kingdom." Jesus answered, "You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink?" They said to him, "We are able." He said to them, "You will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. But Jesus called them to him and said, "You know that the rulers of Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over you. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Some people list that as like the key verse of Matthew. Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And we've talked about this, Jesus' way of spinning things on their head. And he does so in a way to reveal greater reality. Remember, we talked about this. Always transcending. Here's the situation here, and he takes them beyond it. The mother of James and John, we find kind of from other references throughout that her name is Salome. She was most likely Mary's sister. And as Jesus is traveling, you know, he's going towards Jerusalem. He's almost there. He's just told them what's about to befall them. And then Jesus takes the 12 aside, which tells us that there's this group that's moving with them. They're on their way together. It's very possible that Jesus' mom is with him at this point, but so is his aunt, as it turns out. And she asks this question, "Can we have the seats on the right and left?" She's kind of saying, is it possible for us to get bumped up to first class? You just told my sons that there's 12 thrones, right? Places that they're going to judge from. Can they have the best two seats? This may be a little bit of a family favor that she's asking for to her nephew, Jesus. Can we have the really good seats? Oftentimes in a kingdom, these were the positions of importance. You would have your general maybe sitting on your right and the prince sitting on your left, or vice versa. These were the seats of honor, the seats of importance. And she's saying, can this be my two sons? And Jesus, you know, it's interesting to see what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, what a horrible question. Who do you think you are? Right? We're like, gosh, I'm insulted by the very idea. And I think that some of that is Jesus saying, look, that seed in you is planted by me. That deep down, that longing to stand there before your Father and to have him say, well done, is a God-given thing. That desire to live a life that is noble. You know, when you see a certain movie and you just feel like, oh, I want to go out there and do something great. I think Jesus goes, I love that. I love that in you. Peter goes, I want to get out of the boat and walk on the water. And Jesus goes, get out here. But instead he gives like almost a cautionary warning to him. I say, Jesus, we want those positions of importance. The sons we know are kind of in on it because Mark doesn't even include Salome. And he just says James and John are looking for it. And look, the rest of the disciples were too. If you go back a couple of chapters to chapter 18, they're all fighting over who gets the top two seats. Which means that the indignation there that the disciples feel towards James and John is that they leveraged their mom's influence, I think, more than anything. Like, oh, great, you know, what do we have now? Jesus says, you don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup? And this is worth us thinking about because I think Jesus does insist on our greatness. It's what it means to be a follower of him is to move into this. But the way is he extends this cup, his cup, and says, can you drink of it? They say, we can. I think probably what they mean is we want to. And I think it's a statement of courage, even though they don't know what they're talking about. We can. And Jesus says, you will. Right? He says, authority is not his to give. And this is important, that authority is something that is going to flow from the Father. As it turns out, Jesus is in a position of equality and yet in a place of submission. That authority comes through the Father and it will be given to those who the Father deems as worthy. But this cup is an interesting thing. If you look throughout Scripture, the cup is often this picture of this kind of divine providence. We talk about how God has a plan for each one of our lives, and that plan, that purpose, that fate is so often extended in a cup. And sometimes this cup is a cup of salvation that we're to drink from. It can be a cup of comfort, even. Although in this case, given what Jesus has just explained to the disciples, what he's extending to them is most likely a cup of suffering. And he's saying, you are prepared for a throne of judging, but first you must drink the suffering. Now, why suffering? I think that suffering has got several components here that we're going to see. But suffering is a way in which we are prepared for the destiny that's before us. So Jesus is going to say, drink the cup, not of your sins. That's the cup that he's going to drink. He's almost saying here, drink the cup of other people's sins. That the suffering is going to come from being persecuted innocently. It's when our rights are violated. It's when we've stepped out in obedience and been hurt, been wounded, been stepped on. It's when people have wronged us. And you have this cup that's full of those things. And Jesus is saying, drink it. The disciples get angry, and Jesus says, all right, huddle up. He says, look, you know the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be first among you must be your slave. Even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And this is, again, Jesus spinning things on his head. He's saying, greatness in my kingdom is not a position of power and authority. Greatness in my kingdom is a position of sacrificial, surrendered serving others, of laying down our life for the sake of others. It's the model that we've received from Christ. I'm getting caught up here on my notes, sorry. This isn't about conquest. And this is where the disciples get so easily misguided. Peter, at the very end, pulls out the sword and strikes off the ear of, you know, in the garden at the final moments. The disciples are thinking, look, we're here to liberate, but we're here to liberate the Jews, and most likely from the Romans, right? From the oppressors. And Jesus is saying, look, there's a system of government there. There's an authority there of lording it over, and that's the power there, but my kingdom is very different than that. In other words, we're not here to overthrow the Romans and set up a Jewish kingdom. Why? Well, it doesn't go deep enough. Jesus is after something much more fundamental, much more significant. He's after the hearts of every single person. And he knows that in our hearts, if we're given that throne, we'll just set up our kingdom. Have you read that book, Animal Farm? I think Animal Farm is such a great picture of that, where the pigs towards the end are standing up walking, you know, and they cross out the list of commandments on the wall of the barn, and then it says, all are equal, but some are more equal than others. And I think this is the thing that these disciples are going, we want to do the right thing here. We want to be great. And Jesus is saying, okay, but that thing that makes the pigs start acting like the farmers, that thing in you, we've got to fix it. And the way that is fixed happens to be through suffering. I think it's important to note that this is not suffering for our own sort of mistakes. Peter, I think, clarifies this. He says, look, if you commit a crime, you know, if you do something wrong and you suffer, that's not what's in the cup. He says in 1 Peter 4, but let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief, an evildoer as a meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. Isn't that interesting? That cup is a cup of judgment. It's a judgment on the sin. And Jesus is going to say, in the model of what he does, the innocent drinks the judgment of the guilty. He's saying, welcome to the new kingdom. That suffering that we endure innocently is suffering we're enduring for the sake of others. It's a way that we end up participating in the work that Jesus has come to do. And Jesus says, in that suffering comes authority. Is that interesting? My friend Bobby Boyd said this to Jay, so I got this indirectly, and I didn't ask Bobby. I don't see her, so second service I'll have to clarify. But Jay was talking about this idea of kind of the claim of apostolic authority, and you hear that word being used. And, you know, Bobby was saying, all right, you claim apostolic authority, I want to see your back. I want to see some scars. I thought it's just well said that there is something about the enduring of suffering that's what gives us the depth. It's what purifies the heart to where it can be objective, to where it can honestly judge, not just out of fairness, but with a heart of love and compassion, like Jesus. And so how do we drink this cup? I just put down a couple. I think one of the ways that we drink the cup is to forgive, and especially to forgive those who haven't asked for forgiveness. Right? Does anybody have any of those? I have a couple. It's hard to do. You're sitting there waiting, willing to forgive somebody if they would just ask. And Jesus is saying, drink it. Drink it in. Everything in us wants to hold a grudge to like savor what's in the cup. We want to stare at the liquid and go, gosh, I've been so wronged. And Jesus says, drink it down. It's turning the other cheek is how we turn, as part of how we drink the cup. And in turning the other cheek, I think it was Gandhi that had to teach us what this actually meant. I think Gandhi was the one who spoke and said, look, you guys treat that like weakness. Turning the other cheek is strength. It's absorbing a blow. And I think drinking the cup has this same sort of sense to it. Jesus is going to tell us it's like paying a ransom for somebody else. It's like paying money to the release of a slave or the release of a prisoner. This is the only way there's going to be peace in the world, is if somebody will just not retaliate, which is what it means to turn the other cheek, which is what it means to drink the cup. I think that we drink the cup anytime we do something in secret where we're not noticed. Anytime we do the hard thing when we're not going to get recognition. Luke tells us, one who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. These are Jesus' words. And one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. Those faithful steps in small areas that we receive no credit, no praise. Jesus looks at that and goes, all right, now those are trustworthy statements, trustworthy movements towards a position of authority. In Matthew, he says, when you go into your room, shut the door and pray to your Father who is in secret. And your Father who sees in secret will reward you. This is part of the way that we drink the cup, as we remove ourselves from that place of that constant need of affirmation, of recognition. We do those things faithfully. We do those things quietly and in secret. There's so much reality in that sort of action, because the only way you are going to do that is if it's your heart's desire to please your Father, right? You do those things in secret because it's just for Him. In fact, God says, look, if you get the credit for it, your reward is gone. That was your reward. The eternal reward is something much deeper. We drink the cup when we're persecuted, when we're misunderstood, when we speak up for the right things and receive attack. Matthew 5 says, blessed are you when others revile you, persecute you, utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now Hitchens would probably speak up right here and go, ah, see, reward. You're just delaying the gratification. You've been, Jesus tricked us all here and said, trust me, you may be giving up money now, but you're going to get a whole lot of money when you get to heaven. But see, I think Hitchens has completely misunderstood the reward. And the reward is there in heaven, but the reward is, I think, also very much here on earth. The reward being what is happening internally in our hearts as God is renewing it. He's creating depth. I don't think that we go looking for opportunities to suffer. I think this is unhealthy. In fact, I think suffering for suffering's sake is not at all what is in the cup. Suffering can lend itself, I think, to all kinds of false humility. In fact, suffering can be just another way of leveraging your position. Self-pity is a great way to manipulate. And so I think over time, some people have chosen this road of suffering as a way of self-promotion. But Jesus is not fooled at all. This is why that place of secret is so important. This is why being there in front of your Father alone, praying those prayers in secret, asking for that strength as we wait upon the Lord. We suffer for righteousness because it's the noble thing to do. And in so doing it, we participate, as it turns out, in what God did. this verse in 1 Peter is so strong. 1 Peter 4:12 through 13. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. I couldn't help but think of the scene from Les Mis. I mean, it's so familiar that it's become kind of cliche. But the priest and Jean Valjean, are you guys familiar with this scene? Isn't that such a great one? Valjean is a criminal. He's on probation at this point, but he's starving. Nobody will give him work, so he goes and has dinner with this priest. And the priest allows him to stay there in his home. And in the middle of the night, Valjean wakes up and steals the silver. And the priest catches him and says, "What are you doing?" And Valjean strikes him and runs out of there. And the next day is caught and brought forward in chains. And they come and they bring out this bag of silver. And the guard says, "Is this yours?" to the priest. And he says, "Yes, but no, it's actually his. I gave it to him." And they're like, "Okay, what, really? You gave him the silver?" And he says, "Yeah, in fact, I'm so glad you're back here, Valjean, because you forgot the candlesticks, and those, man, that's where the real money is." And he breaks these things out. And Valjean is just standing there baffled as he's looking at this priest. And the priest comes forward, and he actually sends the guards away. They release Valjean. The guards leave. And he comes forward and he says to him, "You've promised to become a new man. You no longer belong to evil. With this silver, I bought your soul. I ransomed you from fear and hatred, and now I give you back to God." And it's such a strong picture of grace, of the cup, of what it does, right? That as we participate in those sufferings, as we extend that love to those who maybe our enemies, right? That's a strong verse. But those are Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. Love your enemies. Why? Because that is grace. And grace is the thing that changes lives. And you participate in such a noble calling when you do. You participate in the cross. You take up your own cross in that case and participate in what Jesus has been doing, what he's called us to do. To extend grace and mercy to the world, to change hearts with that love. And so what Jesus is doing is preparing us for eternity in this, because he's teaching us how to love. And so many of us love out of a neediness in us, a way of receiving some sort of affirmation in return. I think that in this day and age, we're often very comfortable with the idea of unconditional love. Because I think we get a lot of affirmation that you're so important, which is good. We need that unconditional love. But sacrificial love, this is a baffling idea for us. To love when it costs. And so often we're looking for some kind of win-win in this situation. James and John were. Like, "Jesus, we want to serve you, we want to give up everything, but we would like a little bit of recognition at the same time. How do we work out this agreement?" But Jesus is saying, no, we're talking about something different. The great ones in my kingdom are the servants. We see our value so often by our talents and our skills, our uniqueness. I think a hard thing about swallowing the idea that service is greatness is that it puts us all completely on equal footing. Every one of us can serve. Not everyone can do this or this or this, but all of us can serve. And so greatness is an offer to everyone equally. But if you're willing to lay down your life for the sake of others, you can be great in the kingdom of God. So instead of looking for this constant win-win, we end up losing, so to speak. As Peter Kreft says, we lose, which is to say we win. Because what's happening in us is that we are becoming deeper. We're entering into the glory right now. This is another thing that I'm stealing from Rob. He was saying this word kavod, the Hebrew word for glory, is often used with this sense of weightiness, right? To enter into our glory is to become more solid. Nobody captures this better than Lewis in The Great Divorce, when they get these people get a bus ride to heaven from hell. And as they get off the bus, they realize they're like phantoms, they're ghosts, and that the grass is so solid it hurts. And that those who have lived a life in preparation and living this life that Jesus invites us to can walk on the grass and it doesn't hurt because they've got substance. They've got depth. I think this is what, you know, when the psalmist says deep cries to deep. The things that stir our hearts to this sort of greatness are the deepest things about us. And Jesus is saying, I want you to go deeper. I want to make you this new man. I've read this before, and I'm going to just read it again. No apologies here. I actually was talking about this. It's just July 4th, and I was thinking of my friend Mark. And I read this at Mark's memorial about this idea of the new men and the impact that these people make. And Lewis writes this in Mere Christianity. He says, already the new men are dotted here and there all over the earth. Some, as I've admitted, are still hardly recognizable, but others can be recognized. Every now and then one meets them. Their very voices and faces are different from ours. Stronger, quieter, happier, more radiant. They begin where most of us leave off. They are, I say, recognizable, but you must know what to look for. They will not be very like the idea of religious people, which you have formed from your general reading. They do not draw attention to themselves. You tend to think you are being kind to them when they are really being kind to you. They love you more than other men do, but they need you less. We must get over wanting to be needed, and some goodish people, this is the hardest temptation to resist. They will usually seem to have a lot of time. You will wonder the next... you will wonder where it comes from. When you have recognized one of them, you will recognize the next one much more easily. And I strongly suspect, but how should I know, that they recognize one another immediately and infallibly, across every barrier of color, sex, class, age, even of creeds. In that way, to become holy is rather like joining a secret society. To put it at its very lowest, it must be great fun. And this is what Jesus is offering to the disciples and to us. To drink of this cup is to grow into our true selves, which is to say, to grow into our glory, this weightiness. This weightiness that is often not recognized, and yet it's our true self that's being offered to us. Best thing of all, as we stand there and drinking from that cup, as we identify with the sufferings of Christ, we receive his comfort, we receive his strength, we receive his grace. Our pain is transformed. And this is so much what the world needs, is that pain to be transformed. If we don't, we just transmit, right? We transmit our pain to others instead of God finishing that work. In the poem Ulysses, Tennyson says, I drank life to the lees. And that's the picture I get with this cup being offered. I think that the Jeff version of that would be drink life to the grounds, right? The junk at the bottom of the cup, right? As we're drinking that cup, you almost see Jesus lifting it up all the way down. I think we say, like James and John, I'll try. And Jesus is telling us, you can. You can drink it. You can drink this cup of greatness, this cup of glory. And as we do, he makes us deeper, he makes us larger, he makes us greater. In closing, I want to just read from 2 Corinthians a couple verses here. that Paul writes. He says, we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away. Our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Amen.